You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today is Dr. Frederick Fert, who is Google's first Chief Innovation Evangelist. He founded Google's Innovation Lab, where he trained tens of thousands of Googles to develop cutting-edge ideas and taught groundbreaking classes on innovation and creativity at Stanford University for more than a decade. He's got a terrific new book. It's called What's Next Is Now, How to Live Future Ready. The Yes And story, top 10, man. This is and there's two of them. They're both great. So stay to the end. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
But over Frederick Fert, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly, for having me. Super excited about this.
Me too. This podcast loves a good fire story. For some reason, this is something that came up in my life. It comes up in other people's lives. And your new book starts with a fire story. Can you tell us about this one?
Yes. It starts off with an experience that we had with wildfires that were burning here, very close to our house. A mile away. So we could, smell it. We could feel the heat. We could see it. It put us into a place where we heard a knock on the door, and a police officer handed us the evacuation order saying, like, you have about 10 minutes to leave your house. Take what you need to take. Everything is in danger, basically. And that's puts you in a spot where, you know, different emotions arise, right? Emotions like anxiety. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, how is life going to be without, you know, a house where we just moved in? What are the kids' kind of like emotions at that point, and so forth? And I chose a response that was full of optimism, where I said, like, you know, this is an opportunity for us now to gather what we value in 10 minutes, and we tell ourselves that we're going to go on a road trip that we probably don't know if we're going to return from, but at least we're going to, you know, spend some time as a family together. We are all safe now, right? Nobody is hurt. And, let's make the best out of it, because there's an interesting way of looking at that situation where probably a lot of people find themselves in those situations where you don't have control. You can't stop the fires, right? That's something you have to acknowledge and realize. Like, there's no point of you putting water towards that wildfire that's burning incredibly over California. You just can't stop that. What you can do is you can control your inner world, right? How you respond, how you deal with that situation, how you also role model in front of your kids. Like, how do you respond in dangerous situations, right? Are you freaking out? Are you blaming someone else, right? A lot of people I've heard, they just blamed even the firefighters, right? Where I felt like, how can you blame someone who actually wants to help you and rescues you, right? And so We didn't complain and blame anyone. We just basically said, like, this is a great opportunity for us to spend time together. Let's make the best out of it. And it also changed our whole life moving forward, because then we realized how important it is to live with nature, to also put things in place where, you know, we now grow our own food and, we make sure that the fire will not get closer to our house to do forest management, which I also didn't know that this is actually a thing. And just support the local firefighter community as well, right, in the best ways possible, and help others when they are in dangerous situations. So that was an interesting moment for us, which taught us a lot.
Before we started taping, I mentioned to you that I'd spent the week at Quantico, both observing FBI training, and then we also led them through some improvisational exercises and games. And the thing is, you're talking about a potential life and death situation. The folks at Quantico are definitely dealing with life and death. But I think that we do a disservice to ourselves in our regular lives, assuming it's not life and death, because it is. Life is lived in these moments. And what you're talking about, right? What you're talking about, we have a phrase, you need to replace blame with curiosity. And it's exactly what you're talking about, this idea of living fiercely in the moment. And as you note in your book, this is really something that we have loads of as kids. We are awash in this. And then just slowly through education and work, it gets kind of drum out of us. And so what we have to then be, I think, as if we're intending to be lifelong learners, is we have to relearn this stuff, and we have to be intentional about it every day when we walk into our businesses.
Absolutely. Yes. You're hitting a great point that I'm observing too, right? Like, we basically grow up with feeling that a no is a safe place to go, right?
Yeah.
Like, I observe that with my kids, right? When they're very young, you know, the immediate answer is a no, right? Because that's the safest thing for them to explore, right? If you offer them like a new type of food, or go somewhere new, or want to, you know, do a new sport or get on an adventure that they don't know what's going to happen, they mostly respond with a no, right? Because that's just safe. And our minds love to be in a safe place, right? Not engaging in something which is unknown and uncertain. And at the same time, when we grow very old, that reaction comes back, right?
Yeah.
Where I'm observing that with elderly people, where they just love to say no to most things, because it's, again, like creating a safe place for us. And in the middle, kind of like, you know, there is this power of when you say yes, that it takes you on an adventure, right? And I think for me, yes and yes and is really inviting us to embrace possibility. It encourages us to build on what exists and imagine what could be. And that is something very powerful, right? I learned that very early in my life, that a yes just gets you to more, right? It gets you towards possibilities. And it's such an easy thing to say for some people. And for most people, the easiest thing is a no, again, like to get into a safe place. So what I've tried to do in my professional life as well is helping people to just get to a yes, and then maybe go beyond that, go to a yes and, right? And yeah. Kelly, you have been, you know, at the forefront of that. And as you said, like, you know, if you go to different organizations like the FBI, or go to other organizations, and you're trying to really teach them the benefits of this approach that really leads to possibilities, that leads you to momentum, where it shifts us from a place of limitation to a space where innovation and creativity can really thrive. It's that fuel that drives us toward a future we actively then shape. And I think that's very powerful. So I admire the work you're doing. And I think it changed not just my professional career, but it changed my life. So thank you.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, the tech world picked up on this pretty quickly, and that shouldn't be surprising because one of the things that if you're involved in a startup, it is very akin to putting on a play, right? You kind of have to do everything. You've got nothing, so you got to figure out, I got to make the set. I got to hire the right. I got to get a script. I've got to, how do I sell things? How do I market this thing? And so those are unusual places where you get to practice this stuff. So Zappos had a yes and lending library at their sort of headquarters early on, and I talked to Twitter back in the day when it was Twitter and all those things. And you joined Google as the lead learning designer for innovation, creativity, and design. But you said that, quote, you discovered that there is no Google way to innovate, end quote. So talk, because I think people assume there is a Google way, but there isn't a Google way.
I don't think there is any specific way to innovate, right? I think when I started, that's now 14 and a half years back, I was going on a road trip to about 27 offices in about 18 months, trying to discover like what's the Google way to innovate, because everybody was seeing that company building products and services that literally like billions of people were using, right? And very innovative stuff that the world hasn't had seen before. And so I was curious to see like what is that secret sauce? What's the secret way of building these products and building these services? And I, looked at everything. I looked at the spaces and figured out like, oh, maybe that's an environment people are in, right? That it's conducive to creativity and innovation. And then I looked at like processes or specific frameworks, looked at if teams had access to resources, right, that others team didn't have access to. And so after these 18 months in all of those offices around the world, I discovered there is no specific way, right? It's not that one team had a specific environment and a process and some more resources than others. It was specifically the mind state people were in, right? So they had a very specific optimistic outlook on the future. And what I discovered is that they're also very open, right? Open to new ideas, to new perspectives. They really tapped into their curiosity, asking big questions like, what if or why not? Right. And those are very powerful questions to ask. And they had a sense to experiment and try things, right? Really going for, hey, let's give it a try, right? Even if the idea sounds crazy or impossible to do, we're gonna try it anyways and see what we can learn from that. And the last thing I found was this tremendous empathy people have shown to really understand what people actually need in the world. And so all of those deeply human qualities I discovered were, again, like not a space, not an environment, not a process, not a framework, but what I consider like a future-ready mind state. And what's powerful about these is that we all have that at a certain level, right? We all somehow optimistic. We are open, from time to time. We can tap into our curiosity, and sometimes we like to experiment, and we have empathy. But again, like what I want to do is I want to dial those dimensions up. I want to help people to tap even more into those and really use them in hopefully every moment in their life, because I feel like as soon as you do that, you see more possibilities. And if you see more possibilities, you can use those possibilities and turn them into something useful for you and for humanity. And I think that's very, very, very critical.
And one of the things that I have found in my career is that one of the barriers to that is your own success. So I just happened to me a couple of days ago where we were talking about a former colleague and someone brought up a thing, and I'm like, I never saw that. I know this person, I socialized with this person, I did not know a huge swath of their life, and I should have. And I can imagine a younger version of myself would still be beating myself up, like, how could I miss that? I'm such an idiot, that sort of thing. And instead, I kind of went, huh, what a great reminder that we're probably missing it. that all of us are probably missing it. And you can get upset about that, but that's a useless way to face the thing, because there's no way we can know everything. There's not even there's no chance. So that humility is such a superpower, because it does allow you the reframe. It allows you to zoom out. It allows you to maybe see more, but you can only see more if you understand that you're not seeing, if that makes any sense. It's like a cone.
Absolutely, yes. And what I discovered is that exactly what you're saying, like sometimes it's the simple things, right, that are most powerful. For example, helping people to change just one word in their response, which is from a yes, but to a yes, and. Mm-hmm. Right. And you beautifully like demonstrate that in your work too. And this is such a profound thing that whenever I, you know, talk to like CEOs or even governments or like nonprofit organizations or startups, whoever, right, they find it like, you know, in the first place, they see like, oh, that's an easy thing to do. I can change one word in my language, in my response. And then you figure out like, it's actually really hard to do, because what it does, it basically moves you away from stopping everything, right? The yes, but, and finding arguments why something would not work, which our mind loves again. Like we love to find arguments for why something wouldn't work, right? We love to look at obstacles and constraints and all of those things to basically help us to don't take any risks.
Yeah.
And moving towards a yes and, you engage in something, you build something, you're trying to make something bigger, and you go on an adventure. And I think that's something very powerful. And so I made this this exercise, or created this exercise for people to engage in, which is very simple, but it's kind of like an what I consider like a form of art. So I basically just put up an empty canvas, and I gave everyone a paintbrush and some paint. And I ask people to just add one stroke at a time to create a piece of art, not telling them what the piece of art should be, right? But just allowing them to like, hey, everybody here in this group, and if it's, you know, three people, if it's 10 people, if it's 20 people, has a chance to add something to this picture, literally. And it's fascinating because, you know, in the beginning, like people adding like, you know, one stroke, like a small stroke across the picture, and then others add a little bit more of a color, and then something appears, maybe a face or a building or whatever it is, and people start to add to it and so forth. And it gets to a point where everybody says, oh, no, let's stop. Right. I think we're finished. And clearly the picture is not finished. Right. There's like lots of space still empty. And then one person usually comes and just makes a big cross through the picture. And everybody is really annoyed, saying like, oh, how could you destroy this picture? And then I have the whole team pause for a moment and say like, no. The person is playing to the rules. He or she adds a stroke, like just one additional thing. A yes and to the picture, right? And it can cross out the whole thing. That is totally fine. Let's just continue. And so people really hesitate to then continue because they're feeling annoyed. You know, they look at the person saying like, oh, you know, why can you destroy this picture and so forth? And then I teach them an important lesson, which is acceptance, right? Because then you just accept that this stroke is being made and it's fine. Move towards building on it. Use it as something, as a jumping off point to your next thing. And as soon as people get beyond that, it turns into like, you know, the most fun and creative endeavor, because they just switched from being annoyed and saying like, okay, you know, this is something clearly that was not part of the picture or the idea, towards building and creating. And for me, it's where this yes and transforms sometimes fear into curiosity and uncertainty into exploration and resistance to flow. it's about embracing that unknown with optimism and the belief that we can always add something valuable to the mix. And as soon as you learn that and embrace that and experience that, your whole life will change, I promise and I guarantee. And so for me, I like to use this this exercise of drawing a picture together just one stroke at a time. You know, even here in my little art studio when friends come over and so forth, because it really opens them up to new possibilities and working together in a very different way, which I think we can use in our society even more.
Yeah, I mean, it's in our world, we talk a lot about the need to play with your failure. We have a term, you know, make mistakes work for you, that some of the best comedy in the world came from what others would think is an error. Mm-hmm. And you have a really good story around this because you worked on Google Glass, right? Mm-hmm. This is okay. So this is in the eyes of certain people, this is a giant flop that Google had. But there's stuff that came out of Google Glass that was amazing. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So I conducted a couple of workshops with a team to really explore possibilities, right? And worked with the lead designer and the lead project, the head of the project, actually, for quite some time on this, you know, new form factor, new technology, whatever you want to call it. And for me, it was fascinating because what really got us moving forward and make progress was going beyond yes and. Mm-hmm. And so you might ask, like, okay, what's going beyond yes and, right? Because you say something, you accept something and you build on it and so forth. But what then happens is that you can't say, or you can't move forward on every idea, right, in your life, right? There's limited amount of time you have, limited amount of resources, you know, limited amount of people who work on these ideas and so forth. So how can you choose which idea to pursue? And here comes experimentation into the play, where you say yes to every idea. And with Google Glass, you know, we said, like, okay, let's try out to maybe record a voice over the course of the day and see, like, you know, if someone wants to listen back to, like, you know, the things they've said throughout the day. That's one idea. Or how about we just navigate with the device and interact with the device by doing something Tom Cruise was doing beautifully in that movie Minority Report, by putting our hands into the front of our eyes and kind of like just trying to navigate this device, right? All of those ideas, you know, could be explored, and people were like, yes, and, you know, let's do that. And experimentation brought us back to reality, where we said, like, let's give it a try. Let's try out how to interact with that device by, you know, doing the Tom Cruise moves in front of our eyes, which taught you immediately that after about 7 or 8 minutes, your hands get really, or your arms get really tired, right? You can't, sure. Unless you're Tom Cruise, I guess.
Unless you're Tom Cruise, yes.
So you get very tired to, like, you know, move pictures in front of you, or, like, you know, move text or zoom in and zoom out and so forth. So you get really, really tired in your arms. So we threw out that idea because we experimented with it. But the first place we started with a yes and then moved to experimentation. The second idea, like, you know, to record your voice throughout the day, we basically just used an MP3 player and, like, recorded basically one day of everything a person said. And then we found that it's totally useless. Like, nobody wants to listen to it anymore. Mm-hmm. Even, like, when you take pictures throughout the day, like, how often do you actually go back to these pictures? It's very rare, right? So yeah. We basically moved towards experimentation. I think that was a very powerful thing in the project that really led to a tremendous amount of learnings. As every idea you experiment with leads to, like, 2, 3, 4 learnings. And we put categories up that we submitted these learnings into, like, you know, social, technology wise, design wise, functionalities and so forth. And we had a tremendous amount of learnings that still now are very useful in various projects. right? Not just at Google, but in other projects around the world, that could be beneficial. And I think that's something that most people overlook, is that, you know, you go for a project, even if it sounds wild in the beginning, you experiment to really learn quickly what works and what doesn't work. And that's the power of yes and combined with experiments, because experiments help you to make things real and create those learnings.
I've had this conversation with, I work with a lot of academics and I'm married to one. And one of the things that universally they all say is that one of the biggest wastes in academia is the papers that don't work. So
exactly.
that like we just throw those away, and it's like no, there's gold in terms of what it has taught you. There should be a place for that. All right, we don't have that much time, and so I grew up in America in the basically born in 66, so 70s and 80s. I was a soccer kid. That was my thing. My idol was Franz Beckenbauer. That was because none of the Americans were any good. And until we got the Chicago Sting in Chicago, my favorite goalkeeper, Dieter Ferner from Germany, you got to work with the German national football team. That's
exactly,
amazing.
Yes. Yes. I happened to get a call from Oliver Bierhoff. I don't know if you're a fan of
him. Oh, yeah. Of course.
I actually didn't know him, I have to say. I knew that he was somehow like a famous soccer player, but like I didn't have like any idea of like when he was playing, or like that he actually shot the golden goal in one of the World Cups. And so he gave me a call. It was right before I actually was going into teaching a class at Stanford, and picked up the number. It was from Germany. And Oliver Bierhoff was on the phone. He said, like, oh, I just read an article with you in Der Spiegel, which was called in German, yeah, lasst es uns versuchen, which is translated, yeah, let's give it a try, right? So that whole attitude of like,
yeah,
hey, whatever idea you have, just try it out, right? Let's move forward. And that's the whole spirit, I think, around yes and yes and.
Of course.
And he was a big fan of that article, because he said, like, oh, we need more of that attitude in the German Soccer Association or the German football and so forth. And I said, like, oh, great. Yes. So I'm not a soccer fan, I told him. I think he was a little bit, surprised by that. And I said, but I'm super happy to work with you and figure out how we can bring this whole attitude towards an organization to really help it to be more successful. And we worked on various projects over the course of 4 years, actually, in total. And we're still good friends. And he shares a couple of stories of his career and like how he actually helped move the German football into a state of being more open, trying more experiments, trying to really embrace that yes ands and building those rituals. So we worked a lot on this notion of rituals that can really help a team or an organization move from being good to being great. And I think we see the success in the German women's soccer team. We see the success in the organization, and also in many parts is beyond the A team that most people just look at. And I think that was a tremendously interesting project. And he shares a lot of stories in the book. So if you're a soccer fan or not, doesn't matter. I think the stories are very inspiring that Oliver and his teams are sharing.
Yeah, you've got rituals, you've got flow. Team and ensemble, the diversity of teams and the need for that, all of that's in there. Before I ask you for a yes and story, so I get, probably like you, I speak at a lot of creativity and innovation conferences from my particular perch. And a lot of what I end up doing is a pretty big reframe, because I think that there's just some essential misunderstandings of what creativity is and what innovation is, that they're two different things. And you touch on this inside the book. So maybe before we go to the yes and story, we do some debunking. So the first thing for me is that people do think that you're either born creative or you're not. That is just so not true.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just not true. Like, let's leave it like that.
Okay.
And,
What else?
yeah.
What else is not true?
So for most people, creativity is a form of like an output or an outcome, right? We look at the creative piece of art. We look at the creative music that is produced. We look at a creative poem that is written, right? And all of those things. So we look at our creative product, right? Even, and we look at the outcome of creativity a lot. For me, it's more important to look at the process and to like, how are these things developed and created? And so for me, it's really important that we build on what Steve Jobs once coined as connecting the dots, which leads to, a creative idea or something new. What I want to expand on is that, yes, it's about creating, connecting the dots. I think that's important. But what's even more important is that collecting the dots in the first place is something that we can all learn and get better at. And what I mean by that is that we can use all our senses to collect more dots, which means we can collect experiences, information, ideas, whatever it is. And really, as soon as we collect more and more of those experiences, meaningly dots, the chance that we can connect those dots is increasing, right? Because you have a lot more to draw from, right? Your pool of dots is just bigger now. And so that means that you are getting more creative by the ability to then connect more dots. So I want to debunk that myth that first, it's all about the output, the creative output, right? Look at it, listen to it, read it, fantastic. But like, engage more in like, what's the process behind that? And not just about how did two ideas or three ideas connect to lead to something new, but also what was the input for that? What did the person do to collect those dots, right? What are the experience the person had in his or her life to really be able to connect these dots afterwards? And I think that's something we can all learn from and practice more.
Yeah, and the way that I frame it for people is that you can have creativity with zero innovation. That happens all the time, but you can't have innovation without creativity. And so many people try to skip that because the creativity part is rife with failure. It's messy. It requires all these inputs, which means it's complex. But that nothing becomes innovative because it was like all if it was already made, there's no innovation there. So it's just this really this weird little like chasm that exists in the business world writ large, but in very creative companies, and that's it. And tech up companies have to be creative because you have to come out with a new thing. You know, they like you're and Second City has to put on a new show. It can't be the old show. They'll know it's the old show. They're not going to buy tickets to it again. And it's the same thing in the world that you live in. And it's the true of the world that we all live in. It's just not something that is understood. And is not just the understanding, and you talk about this in the book writ large, it's the practice. You have to
Absolutely.
practice over and over and over again. And again, not everyone's really comfortable with that. Okay, I'm going to ask you, we always ask your yes or yes and story. This feels like the layup of all layups for you because you live your life yes and, but I will ask you for a yes and story.
Perfect. So, yeah, I might share too.
Great, love it.
to just be in that spirit of yes and. Literally. So you're right. Yes, I'm really living a life that is mostly guided by this notion of saying yes. And so what I found as a parent of three children is that, the tendency to say no is pretty high,
Yes.
right? There's many good reasons for that. You want to protect your kids, you want to just move on with your own agenda because you think you have something more important to do when you, say yes to an idea from your child, right? It takes time, right, to explore that and go on that adventure and so forth. So there's many good reasons for saying no. But we pushed that out and said, how about we do a yes day from time to time? And there's even a movie about that that we used for some inspiration as well. And I said to my kids, like, what do you think about a yes day? And they said, like, oh, that sounds wonderful, right? Like, can we literally say any idea we want and you say yes to them? And I said, like, I think that's the spirit of it. Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's risky, but it was one of the most beautiful days, not just because it brought out all of those creative ideas that we went on and explored, but it also brought out the values of our children, where they actually asked just for the things that, you know, they felt that are making, you know, our family happy, that everybody wants to do. There was not a lot of materialistic things involved, right? It was mostly like experiences or adventures that we went on. And it was all okay. So there were no, like, you know, totally crazy, wild things that we actually had to say no to because they were just impossible to get or to do. And it was beautiful because we, you know, we went for a nice lunch together. We went to the beach. We did a couple of things that we haven't done before. And then obviously, like, there was this question, like, let's go into a toy store, right? The kids were like 6, 8 and 10. And so, or 12, 6, 8 and 12, sorry. And so we said, like, okay, let's go to a toy store. Why not? And when we entered the toy store, you know, they said, like, oh, you're going to say yes to everything we want? And I said, yes, here's my credit card. Like, go and you can buy the whole store if you want, because mm-hmm. that's the spirit of it. And guess what they got?
What'd they get? Like, nothing. Zero? Nothing. I was going to guess, like, zero. A tiny car or something. No, they got nothing.
They had, wow. Yeah. So obviously wow. They looked at the biggest things in the beginning, right? The big Legos or the big boxes, super expensive. And so they looked at me and I said, you have the card. So, like, go for it. And, you know, my heartbeat went up. Obviously.
Oh, completely. No. This is idiotic of you to do, but brilliant. It's both.
And then they knew that they literally could get everything.
They could.
And with that knowledge, they went for nothing, which was fascinating.
Oh,
and that's
God,
such
yes.
a powerful lesson in our lives that if we have the chance to get everything, we mostly end up with the things that, you know, we truly value. And that was the time together, right? It was the fun of the just going for it, right? And having that experience. And we left that store and I felt very, very happy because, you know, all the things that you wanted to teach your kids, right, about what's valuable, like material things are, like, you know, things that, you know, are hopefully not that valuable in your life, right? The most important things is the relationships that we have so forth. That truly came through. And that made me very happy to see that they didn't go for anything. And we, you know, can do more yes and yes days in our lives because it's just going to be a fun thing to do.
Unbelievable.
So that's the first,
I'm going to let you tell the second one, but I just want to, like, say this, which is you gave them trust. And it's not like children don't understand trust, and they are not given trust very often by parents, by school teachers, by other people. So they recognize the gift. What an incredible, I would imagine that singular experience is going to be something that sticks with them their whole life in such a great way. That's my thought.
Yes, hopefully.
Hopefully.
And you're right. I think how often in our lives can we give trust to others, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean full trust. Right.
Right.
To your team, to your boss, to your partner, to a stranger, right? And when we do that, most of the time we're going to be surprised, you know, ends up going to happening. And so we should go for it, absolutely. So the second one is a shorter one, but or even it's also a very personal one because it's about getting married to my wife. So we got married on an island, not asking anybody for permission, and also not telling anybody that we're gonna get married. We just went for it. We had our first child, Jonathan, and then we got married. And we, in a couple of years later, we actually said we're gonna do it again.
Uh-huh.
So it's something that I try to live by in my life, is that I'm trying to do things only once, right? Mm-hmm. And on a small scale, you know, not going to the same restaurant or sleeping in the same hotel, but also on a bigger scale. And obviously getting married is on a very big scale. So I broke that philosophy and said, oh, we're going to get married again because we just loved it so much and we're going to do it somewhere else and so forth. And then we ended up really in that yes and spirit, got married again. So three times at Burning Man last year.
Great.
Without getting divorced in between. So I have
nice,
to,
very nice.
So we just kept going, like getting married over and over again, because we just explored, or we just enjoyed that experience and explored like what's the difference now in getting married again, and like just, you know, recommit again and so forth. And it's in the stars, or it's the universe will decide with us if we're going to get married a fourth time. I'm very optimistic about it. So that's just the spirit of, like, you know, if you enjoy something, go do it again and enjoy that second time, third time, and make those the best experiences in your life.
So in comedy, there's a thing called the rule of three. So what I'm going to suggest to you, three is great. You can't stop at four. You've got to go all the way to six. You just got to do the threes. That's just my recommendation to you. And I'm also going to assume that marriage number three was pretty muddy last year at Burning Man, right?
Absolutely. It was one of the best places to be stuck.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we'll leave it on that. The book is called What's Next Is Now, How to Live Future Ready. Dr. Frederick Fairt, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.